April 8th. I'm pregnant. I just got off the phone with the nurse from Dr. Lowen's office. I picked up the old brown trimline phone that's been in this retreat cabin of my mother's forever, and a woman's voice asked for me, and I said, "This is she," and the voice said, "It's Becky from Dr. Lowen's office," and I said, "Uh-huh." Then Becky said, "The result from the latest test was positive," and I said, "Positive?" And she said, "Yes, you are no longer borderline pregnant." No longer borderline pregnant? I thought I might fall over. I looked out the window at the leaves of the poplar trees shimmering in the breeze. My eyes settled on a vulture falling from the sky in a perfect spiral. He was flapping, then gliding as he descended. And I thought to myself, I will remember this moment and that vulture for the rest of my life. I thought to myself, that vulture is a sign. A part of me is dying. And then the nurse said, "Hello?" And I said, "Yes, I'm here. Are you sure I'm pregnant?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Really? Are you sure? You're not going to call me back in 2 hours and say you made a mistake?" And she said, "No." And I said, "Well, how do you know?" She sighed. It was a ridiculous question. But since she had been telling me for a week that after 3 blood draws, they still couldn't tell if I was really pregnant, I felt justified. So I pushed. "Well, what do you know today that you didn't yesterday?" And she said, "The HCG levels are definitely going up." "HCG levels?" "Yes, in the last 24 hours, the pregnancy hormone count has risen from 700 to over 2300, and that usually means a healthy, robust beginning." And then I had what could only be the first twinges of the maternal instinct. "Healthy and robust?" A huge smile spread across my face. "That's my baby." And then it was as if the synapses in my brain sending exploratory signals to my uterus finally made contact. "Hey, mate, is it a go down there?" "Yes, yes, Captain, we're full steam ahead." I was convinced that getting off the phone would exponentially increase my chances of reverting to not pregnant, but I released Becky anyway and stumbled over to the bathroom, where Glenn, my life partner and father of our soon-to-be born baby, was shaving. I looked into his eyes and tried to keep myself from screaming and jumping up and down. "We did it," I said. He grinned. "Well, I guess that puts the whole motility question to rest." And I said, "I guess it does." Then I wrapped my arms around him and buried my face in his chest, and he wrapped his arms around me and rested his chin on the top of my head. I was in ecstatic bliss for about 90 seconds, and then it hit me. An avalanche of dread that took my breath away. Pregnant? A baby? What have I done? I looked at Glenn. He was going through his own reality check, which brought me even closer to the brink of total hysteria. But then, before I could burst into tears and run screaming out of the room, he pulled me into his arms. "You are going to be a fantastic mother," he said to me, to my fear. His love overwhelmed me, and I started to cry big, wet tears onto his favorite black shirt. "We're going to have a baby."
Good morning. This is Black Book Talk. I'm Patricia Welch.
And I'm Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman.
And that was author Rebecca Walker reading from her latest book, Baby Love. Rebecca, welcome to Black Book Talk.
Thanks for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
It's appropriate that we have her here talking about her new book, Baby Love, Choosing Motherhood, because this is May, Mother's Day month.
Yeah, when I was introducing you, I felt like I should say, and this is Rebecca Walker, mother of Tenzin. Tell us about your baby.
Oh, my baby. He's of course, I'm the doting mom like every other mom. I think he's a genius. He's, you know, the cutest baby ever. Let's see. He's 2, and he's right now doing a lot of talking and playing with his truck and building with blocks and, you know, wanting me to hold him all the time and telling me that he wants snacks and he wants peanut butter toast and he wants apple juice and, you know, he's a baby.
He's 2.
Yeah, he's 2. Yeah, and I'm totally ridiculously in love with him, you know. I mean,
right.
Yeah.
It doesn't change.
Yeah.
Between mothers and daughters, it kind of wavers. It goes back and forth, But with my sons, I adore them even when they're angry. That part doesn't change, I think.
Yeah, I can see that. When I was pregnant, and I, you know, the questions that you get when you're pregnant, you know, girl or boy, do you have a name picked out? Is this your first, you know? And whenever I told people that I was having a boy, well, not every time, but most times, people would say, you're so lucky because boys love their mamas.
Yes.
You know, and I really get that now, you know. There's a really special bond there.
You know, when I heard you read the borderline pregnant line, I was like, what's with this borderline pregnant? I mean, you go to the doctors, they take the test, you are your aunt, and I thought somehow this is a metaphor for the whole pregnancy. So just talk a little bit more about that it took 3 tries for the doctor's office to know.
I know, you're so right. It's such a metaphor. I mean, it's the ultimate in ambivalence. Even my biology was ambivalent. Yeah, well, apparently, the hormone that tells you whether or not you're pregnant was, on the first test, it was present. Then on the second test, the level had dipped a bit. So they weren't sure if I had lost the baby or if there was some, you know, something going on there. So they needed to keep testing to make sure that the levels were going up, which meant that the baby was growing and doing what he was supposed to be doing. But it was agony for 3 days, you know, like, well, what, you know, what do you mean borderline? You know, it was, I'd never heard of that before, you know.
Yeah. My experience is so different. So when I read that, I remember just kind of laughing. I would go to the doctor thinking, oh, please don't let me be pregnant again. Because we have 5 children. So it's like, oh, and I read this in borderline pregnant. I too went, borderline?
I know. Weird, right?
Well, there's a teacher at our school who wants to be pregnant. And so every month we're going through this. So.
So you would go and you would think, please don't let me be pregnant. Every time.
I am the oldest of 6. My mother is in the middle of 9, and my grandmother is one of 19 children. So in my family, we're all fertile myrtles. So I was always like, oh, don't let me be pregnant again.
And are you happy that you had 5?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Would you have more? Would you have less? Or 5 is the perfect number? Or what's your thinking on that? 5 is a lot.
I'm Catholic.
I hear you.
Okay. I would have had more.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't.
Right.
But no, I wouldn't say 5 is the magic number.
Oh, it's never too late, Emma. There are hormones.
I think it's a little late for me. But I don't think 5 is the magic number. I'm 1 of 6, and that works too. My mother's oldest sister has 17, and they're all wonderful. And she's so calm and patient, unlike me. But I think there is the number for you.
Right.
There's no, like, ideal. Like, some people think 2 is ideal.
Right.
And that might be ideal for some families.
I just can't imagine. I mean, there's a part of me that wants 5, and I always say if I could, I'd have 10. But then the effort, the energy, the money, I mean, that it all takes is astounding. So when I think of having 5, I'm in awe of your stamina and will to survive, you know. But does it get easier? I mean, when you have more than, you know, everyone says if you have 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, you know, they play together and you don't have to do as much. But is that just hogwash?
I'm not sure it's easier because we had 4 close together. Mm-hmm. Then 10 years passed and we had the last child.
Mm.
And he didn't have a playmate except for me.
Mm.
And he's very funny. Sometimes he talks about that. He says, I still play. Mm. And he's 19 and he doesn't want to play with me anymore. But when I think of people who have a lot of children, imagine being intimately involved with 10 kids. 10 kids who, you know, no matter what, they love you and you can count on them. And plus, it's family. So it somehow works out. I'm a teacher, so I look at the families that come in and they have differing amounts of children. It's just amazing how family survives. And I think it has to be that way. Mm. That no matter how many you have, you somehow have the capacity to love all of them. Mm-hmm. And that they, in turn, have the capacity to love you no matter how flawed you are.
That sounds good. Yeah, I definitely could see that the my capacity to love is infinite, you know.
Yeah.
Well, think about it. After your pregnancy, which was to me not exactly the idyllic sort of, I'm just sitting there waiting for the child, feeling it grow, kind of pregnancy, and yet you're sitting here considering another. So tell us a little more about the pregnancy, how the test, you know, just determining the pregnancy was sort of a metaphor for the whole process.
Yeah, I mean, the book is really about how ambivalent I was. I had always wanted a child and longed for a child, but I had a lot of different ideas about what that would mean for my life, that it would mean that I would no longer be able to pursue my sort of creative aspirations, that I would be landlocked, unable to move, immobilized on a certain level, drained of my energy. And as a child of divorce, I was also very concerned that I would not be able to maintain the kind of intact family that I wanted to give any child, you know. So my pregnancy was really racked with these issues, you know, those issues, and then the issues that the pregnancy raised, which were several, and everything from, you know, should I go with a midwife or the Western paradigm of medicine, or to, you know, why is it that before every woman gets an amniocentesis, she has to give all of her genetic history to a biotech company that puts it in a computer and uses it God knows how. So the pregnancy was really a kind of living journey from ambivalence to certainty, you know, and at every step I was negotiating.
I don't know how much you want to talk about, but I have to admit, the ultimate decision in terms of the delivery really surprised me. You know, I said, oh, she'll probably go to a birthing room, and she'll be sitting there saying, no, I'm just going to squat. I don't want to sit down. I don't want to lie down, or I'll just be sitting. But you came around on that one. Could we talk a little bit more about the midwife versus conventional?
Yeah,
and
I mean,
having a friend involved.
Oh, my geez. Yeah, well, you know, I thought that I was going, as I write in the book, I thought I was going to have this idyllic birth. You know, I'd be in the hot tub and, you know, somebody be playing some fabulous music and giving me head massage with lavender oil and feeding me organic chocolate cake. And the reality was that once that pain hit, I was, you know, basically I got through about, let's see, we started at 8. I would say I got the epidural at, you know, like maybe 4 the next morning. So I got through a good 8 hours of agony. I mean, just agony. I was screaming. I was saying, I don't know how human beings do this. You know, I was cursing. I was a mess, basically. And then finally the anesthesiologist came in, and that epidural was, you know, to me it was like the Holy Grail. You know,
you did kind of sound like the poster child for epidural.
I know. I was like, yes, an epidural. And you know, for the women who can have natural childbirth and you know, they go 6 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours, 14 hours, and it doesn't completely wipe them out, I say amen, fantastic, I support you 1,000%. But for those of us who have a very low pain threshold, my baby had complications. He had meconium aspiration, and he was a very big baby. He was 9 pounds 11 ounces, I think. And you know, that was a lot, a baby to come out of my body, you know. So I support women having it, their child however they need to have their child. I got over my judgment of scheduled C-sections. I'm now like, look, if you want to go schedule C-section, you go right ahead. You know, I'm cleared of thinking that any way, one way of having a baby is better than any other.
It was a real transition, and I said, okay, this is really an honest book, and this isn't just, yes, and the harps were playing, and I want to tell everybody, I'm going to give you my harpist number. I said, oh, no, this is real. I appreciated that a lot. I said, okay.
I think a lot of people appreciate that part because the mythology around childbirth has been so airbrushed, you know, in general, that a really vivid, true account of the drama of it can be very helpful to people.
Yes.
Did you have harps?
When I was reading it, I thought, and the whole myth of slave women laying down in the fields and giving birth, cutting the cord with a hoe and getting back up and working, oh no.
And do you know that one of my coaches that came in and gave us a little teaching, I think I write about this in the book, we had a childbirth class, and she came in, and one of the things that she showed was this video of women in, I think it was Brazil, who didn't go to the hospital. They just squatted down, and this was like a video show, so I'm turning on the TV, I'm watching these women. They squatted down and just like pushed the baby out, you know, and then they got up and went back to work.
Yeah.
You know, and that was, you know, interesting, but not helpful in terms of, you know, what I could expect, you know.
And also, we don't talk about the mortality rate for mothers and children in those situations.
Exactly.
So, you know, I mean, this is perhaps why these women are not living very long.
Exactly.
Why these children are unhealthy. So,
thank you.
Could we talk a little bit about Glenn?
Sure.
Just
my favorite subject.
Yes, because I want to hear more about Glenn.
What do you want to know?
You have to write more about Glenn. How's he doing?
Glenn is good.
Involved.
Oh yeah, Glenn is great. He's great. He's the best partner I've ever had. He's a wonderful father.
Talk about getting to Glenn, because I mean, had you not met Glenn,
it never would have happened.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, folks, not just in the obvious way, but I mean, you know, she had to really consider what she needed. Well, just talk about this. He's not the first attractive person that you met. You could have had this baby sooner, but you didn't.
Yeah,
I'll tell you this part about coming on the show. We want all your business.
Well, actually, it's true. I had been trying to get pregnant, you know, over years in a kind of ambivalent way, choosing partners that were inappropriate. And I write about that in the book. And I was with a musician for many years, and we were trying to get pregnant, but I was with a woman musician, so we were trying to get pregnant with these various men who wanted to have kids with us. It was very interesting, and I ended up having a huge list of people who were willing to have a baby with me.
So, folks, you can call her up.
No, that part of my life is over.
Oh, no, I just think you could refer them if they're still looking for a woman to have a child with, then, you know, just... They're out there. Look, the telephone lights start flashing. It's not a call.
It is possible. But it wasn't until I met Glenn at a Dharma retreat, actually. He's a teacher of Buddhism, that I really found someone who responded immediately and decisively to my longing to have a child. And he, you know, the second I said I want to have a baby, and I had said this to many other people, he said, well, absolutely you want to have a baby. I completely understand, you know, your desire and your longing, and it's one of the most transformative experiences a woman can have and a human being can have. And, you know, and I support you in that desire. And, of course, that was in the beginning of our relationship, and I really didn't know that it would end up being that he would be the person. But it was, and I'm so glad that it was, because he's really the best.
You are a Buddhist, too. Do you think that you could have, that the fact that he is a Buddhist and shares your faith, that had something to do with it? Could you have had a successful experience, I mean, the whole experience with someone who is not a Buddhist?
I think I could have, but I feel that being Buddhist for us means that whatever obstacles there are mentally to moving forward in one's life and manifesting what it is you're here to manifest. Those mental obstructions or obstacles can be dissipated, you know, as part of your Buddhist practice. That's part of what we do. And so it was through our connection and our understanding of that work of clearing one's mind that I was able to clear my ambivalence and a lot of the grief that I was carrying from my abortion and a lot of the patterning that led me into relationships that weren't healthy for me. So I think that if I hadn't had that grounding in that kind of work, spiritual work, I don't think I could have gotten here with the kind of joy and clarity that I've been able to manage.
Okay.
Can you talk a little bit about your relationship with your father?
Sure. What do you want to know?
Well, I was struck by when you left college, you were saying you put all your stuff, when you left your first year of college, you put all your stuff in garbage bags and your dad, and you threw them in the back of your dad's Volvo. And then when you were pregnant, he moved you from one place in California to another. The same thing, but only now you're in your 30s. Just this whole idea of, and you talk about how you didn't spend much time with your dad after the divorce, and then sporadically at other times. Could you talk a little bit about what that feels like?
Sure. That actually, my father coming forward in that way during my pregnancy was really wonderful and healing. He was very supportive, and I think in many ways that he is my model for men. You know, that he's loving, he's stable, he's conscious. He's a good human being. He's always worked to protect people who can't protect themselves and to support people who need support. And I'm glad that I had him as a model for masculinity, because I think that when all of my boyfriends in my life have had these qualities, you know, of being very decent, good human beings. So my relationship with my dad is very good. We did have that time apart after the divorce, and I was raging at him when I was an adolescent, and certainly at the end of Black, White, and Jewish, my first book, I was not sure how we were going to surmount the chasm between us. But we have really worked hard on our relationship. I think one of the things that really helped is that he embraced Black, White, and Jewish and my story and said, I understand what you're saying and I'm sorry for what I did to kind of leave you out there not knowing how to navigate. And that admission was very healing, that kind of, you know, that apology.
And with your stepmother, you wrote that she says that she raised you as one of her children, and you said you believe that that's mostly true.
Well, my stepmother, you know, I think that in her mind, she probably did that. But, you know, the reality of my experience was not that. I think that stepchildren are often highly attuned to the differences in the way they're treated versus their biological siblings. And I mean, this goes all the way back to Cinderella and the Ugly Duckling. I mean, this is a trope in our culture that is known. And, you know, she was a loving maternal figure, but there was always a bond between her and her biological children and that I always felt outside of. And I don't fault her for that. I think having a biological child of my own forced me to to experience the difference in my feelings toward him and from the feelings that I felt towards the child I was co-parenting with my ex-partner for many years. I love my first son, I call him. I mean, I adore him, but there is a difference there for me. I didn't choose to bring him into the world. I didn't mate with another human being in order to create him. I didn't, you know, he wasn't a newborn. I didn't nurse him. He doesn't look like me. There's no genetic mirroring going on. It's a very different journey. And that's really what I'm talking about in the book, is the difference and creating a space for people to be able to talk about the difference, as opposed to this sort of blanket statement that it's all the same.
We have about a minute left. Just anything else that you want to share, your learning?
I think one of the most important messages of the book is that young women need to be practical about planning for children in this day and age, that, you know, fertility is finite, resources are scarce, cultural support is minimal at best, and you need to be as savvy and as concentrated in your planning for how you're going to have a baby as you are for how you're going to build your career.
Thank you so much for joining us. You know, we needed an hour on this one. Half an hour is just not enough, but that just means you got to come back or you got to call back.
It'd be my pleasure. It was fabulous being here with you all. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Well, until next month, this is Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman, saying bye-bye.
And this is Patricia Welch, the Library Lady, saying good reading to you. You know, next month we're talking about those books of no particular literary value, beach books.